Welcome to this week's Reaction Podcast. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor. I'm joined by Ian Martin, Editor of Reaction. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our website. You can find that at www.reaction.life. And we're going to kick off this week by talking about the American presidential race, in this case the Democrat primaries, and the debate in Nevada, Las Vegas, I think. And we're going to try and answer a simple question. Has Mike Bloomberg blown it? Ian, what's your initial feeling?
Well, just before you press the record button on this, you made a good point, Alistair, which is that maybe in this case, all of the punditry's wrong all of the time, and it's very difficult to work out, because you could read this as Bloomberg, who by common ascent did not do particularly well and was really beaten to a pulp in certain respects by Elizabeth Warren, a candidate who's struggling, and correctly people diagnosed this as a win for Sanders because Sanders was relatively unscathed. And for those who haven't been paying attention to the race, which is fascinating, it is Bloomberg has been spending hundreds of millions of dollars of his own fortune, hasn't actually debated until this week in the debate in Nevada, and he was going to be the target. Now, it was presented in the run-up to it as, here comes Bloomberg, the moderate candidate who, now that Biden is disappearing, he's the person who can take on Sanders and maybe get the nomination. But because he did badly, he's being written off today. But as you, the point that you made, as I said a moment ago, Alistair, was that maybe all the commentary is wrong and you just need to let it play out.
Well, throughout the race, you've had various moments where candidates have been perceived to be doing better. And it's happened to no-hopers like Kamala Harris. It's happened that Buttigieg had a bit of a moment, seems to be fading slightly. So it's, I mean, it's a banal point, but it's, as a commentator, it's easy to get drawn into over-interpreting things that are happening day to day, especially when it's a big marker, like a debate, where you can objectively say, you know, have a discussion about whether someone did well or did badly. I mean, the question is really to ask is, are the campaign ads landing in the states that they need to land when it comes to Super Tuesday, where a huge swathe of the delegates to get chosen, if that's the right phrase. Get selected, and Bloomberg is, you know, intends to spend something like up to $2 billion if he wins the nomination. And the more cynical of my American friends, who are probably on the left, say this is how American democracy is bought, and it's hard not to disagree when you see his performance on stage in comparison to the ads. And in the ads, he's this sort of titan of American industry, a man of incredible, you know, sensitivity and eloquence, but also achievement. And then on stage, he'd clearly been told, I think, to look like he's above the fray.
Yes.
And to, you know, his whole narrative has been spun, you know, that look at these people, they can't, I mean, the emotional side to it is the debate, the race has looked, I imagine most Americans, like a bit of a chaos. The way the votes were counted in Iowa was a shambles. All of the candidates have knocked chunks out of each other so far.
Yeah.
And then the idea is for Bloomberg to come in and look like the adult in the room. And to do that, he tried to sort of keep his cool and not really engage, which just looked very lethargic.
Yeah. There were various moments when Warren was going at him where you thought, there's a killer line here, and he's been good informally in interviews and that sort of thing with killer lines. You know, the line about Trump when someone asked him, "Do you think that the American public really wants a runoff in the general election between two New York billionaires?" And he said, "Why? Who's the other one?" Now that's a good line, but for some reason he, as you said, lethargic's a good word. He had been advised to not really engage, but the result is he just took a pummeling for. I didn't watch the entire thing. I watched the edited highlights, but there weren't many positive moments for him. But then also, what really troubled me as someone who wants to see a proper race and would love to see Bloomberg v. Trump, So there's a bit of confirmation bias involved as well, because it would be such a great race. The media would love it, and actually I think it would be a very good contest, money aside. Is that he, when he got onto the substance of his argument, which is clearly where the Democrats need to be, he was booed. So when he had his line about, we're not going to do away with capitalism, and he has a very particular take on reforming capitalism.
He was booed.
Right. He was booed, roundly. Mm. And it's not even as, it wasn't even as though there was part of the audience there that appeared to be, now it's a debate audience and it's skewed. But I thought that was mildly depressing. I mean, it was him delivering. You could from a left point of view, you could argue that that's him just using the sort of tired old Blairite, Clintonite tropes about capitalism. I think the reality is that the American electorate is not going to opt for socialism, which is what Bernie is.
Yeah, and he's sort of, well, you feel that with Bernie, and I understand he's different to Corbyn in, you know, the comparison doesn't resonate in lots of ways because he never shilled in the same way as Corbyn has for dictators in the same way.
He was more pro-Soviet though. Remember, video of him actually being there and praising the underground in Moscow is quite embarrassing.
But in that period there were plenty of people on the left who were blind and intelligent people who were blind to what was happening and to the nature of that regime. I mean, with Corbyn, there were very few people who were quite as sympathetic as he has been to, for example, Serb nationalism, Bernie Sanders is on record as being aggressively anti. So on the foreign policy stuff, I don't know enough maybe about Sanders' worldview to have some clarity about it. But he seems, where there is the similarity is, I think, the whole atmosphere around Bernie, this constant language of we need a radicalism and radical transformation and nothing else will really do. But then simultaneously saying we need to be incredibly radical, and there's his rhetoric is a bit like Corbyn, it's mounting up these terrible things which are all about wealth and power and were about bringing power back to the working class or the middle class, and he does it repeatedly.
I agree with you that it looks like left nostalgia really, and you just reminded me of that Blair gave a very, very interesting speech today about the future of the Labour Party, where he challenged a lot of this thinking, I think, and I'm not a great fan of Tony Blair, but it was one of the most interesting, coherent presentations I've read on what's wrong with the left and where it needs to completely rethink. And he made the point about technological change. Now, Blair always thinks that everything's going to change utterly. He's a progressive. It's all change, change, change. That was a sort of mantra throughout his premiership. But he's right that the shape of the economy is changing. I think I read the other day that only 15% of the economy that is going to be online is currently online. So this is we're only at the beginning of what it's going to do to consumption patterns, to retail, to media, to everything that we consume and use. Now, in those circumstances, a Bernie version of labour rights, big union politics, high spending state, just is the politics of the 1970s, or is attempting to recapture a world or an economy that's not going to exist in 10 or 20 years' time, thanks to technological change. And Blair's right, I think. If there is a way back for the mainstream moderate centre-left, it's to engage with that and to offer people reassurance and a degree of protection, or greater protection than they might get, for example, from Boris Johnson. But there is absolutely no sign that I can see, and people who I follow on the left and listen to on the left, and some of them try to assure me that it's the Labour leadership race in Britain is not as bad as it looks, and that it's just a process they have to go through, genuflecting to the internal electorate, and that actually Labour will be back. But Labour can be back and Keir Starmer in the House of Commons can beat up on Boris Johnson, but if they don't have and a proper analysis rooted in how the economy is going to change, and what it is to be a mainstream person of the moderate centre left. And I think every time you get to an election, unless it's in a moment of great economic crisis where people would feel they need to fling the government out, then you're going to be found out by the electorate. Yeah, and the Democrats are in the same position.
And and a way of appealing directly to people's interests. I mean, Lisa Nandy put it quite well in an op-ed she wrote for The Guardian after the election defeat. She said, the Labour Party, were talking about nationalising the railways, and a lot of our, you know, red wall seats are nowhere near our, you know, the rail network. Most people drive.
Mm.
So what are people hearing? They're hearing an expensive plan to satisfy some vision of the Labour left of what the 70s were like or what the 60s were like. And it's that, as you say, it's nostalgia, really.
Mm.
And it's a sort of weird dream trip where
I'm not sure
you just need these massive... I come into that concept with that attitude repeatedly, is Sanders isn't pro massive nationalisations, but he's pro massive economic transformation in other ways.
Yeah.
But it's particularly on that part of the left which has dominated for a while. It's this sort of just relentless attitude that cherry picked random notions of what they think is left wing, i.e., once the state ran utilities, it should do again, are in some way linked to how the economy now functions. And you're right, it's going to change that. And the cleverer ones are sort of utopian about AI and automation and say this will open up new avenues. But we're not at a tipping point yet where that has transformed the economy out of all recognition.
No, we're not. Then the other challenge you have to, that people have to think about is net zero.
Hmm.
Now, there'll be some people listening to this just saying, well, that's a load of stuff and nonsense. That's the government making commitments that it won't keep. But the entire machinery of government in the UK is committed now to net zero, which I was talking to an economist about this the other day, who just said he just cannot see how this can't be done with enormous economic pain, such as the scale of the commitment. So those people that you're talking about, that Lisa Nandy's talking about, is government policy is going to have to be to effectively almost drive them off the roads.
Yeah.
And as you say, they're not on the rail network. Building new parts of the rail network is going to be very expensive. It's going to be very expensive. So briefly back on Bloomberg then. So his historian friend of mine who said to me before the debate, this is just media bubble wishful thinking on Bloomberg, and he's spending loads of money. Let's see how he does on the stage. He may well be right that then Bloomberg has blown himself up in Nevada. The case against that is that there's still a lot of Democrats who ultimately, their clear goal is to beat Trump this year. And if those ads land, as you said, ahead of Super Tuesday, and if he can start picking up serious amounts of delegates, then there is a chance. Yeah. Should we talk a little bit more about the Labour leadership, which is...
Yeah. Well, just coming back to one thing. One, the argument for Bloomberg, which a lot of people, it's just very simple. Bernie is way too kooky, and I just want a guy who's been around the block a little bit. That's actually a very powerful argument.
It is. He also poses, another caveat, people have bad debates.
Exactly, yeah.
Reagan had bad debates. Trump had debates where in 2016 at various points in the cycle, and I was there a lot in 2016, there was huge excitement very briefly around candidates that were definitely going to stop Trump.
Yeah.
So Scott Walker, governor of somewhere that we can't remember where, who rode a motorcycle, was going to be the hope of the slightly more of sort of fiscally conservative, sensible Republicans who are against Trump. He was blown up very easily by Trump. Marco Rubio was the great hope for a while, went absolutely nowhere. Saw what happened to Jeb Bush even before that. And so Trump survived all manner of terrible performances and weird things and scandals. So there's a scenario in which that happens to Bloomberg, but he still manages with his money and with the key message to get through. Because I think the great thing in his favour, as well as you said, he's not cookie-like, like Sanders, is the key thing is that he's not an economic risk. So if you're, I mean, if you're voting for Bernie, you have to want economic change. But if you are a floating voter or a moderate moderate Democrat thinking about the economy, and you see Sanders, then you see trouble for yourself and your own finances in the years ahead. If you see Mike Bloomberg, he's probably more reliable on the economy than Trump. But just then on the Labour leadership campaign.
Problem for Bloomberg is he's too small.
Right.
And what Trump has already picked up on with the mini Mike stuff, The Economist did quite a nice bit of data analysis. I think it's something like in almost every race in the last 100 years, the taller candidate has won.
That's true. But did they do a graphic on how many lunatics have been president of the United States? Because, I mean, sorry, Trump's not a lunatic, but Trump may be tall, but in lots of other respects, he's not. He doesn't fit the model of an American president.
I'm just saying that Mini Mike, you know,
quite possibly.
He doesn't have a shot against the big man, you know.
Well,
that's your political analysis there. But it's quite interesting.
Oh, Boris is accounting for that. Boris is not tall.
That's true. But Trump, he's obviously picks up on the Economist, you know.
Yeah,
he's read his stuff and he knows that it's a bit of a factor.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this and wondering how tall Alistair is, he's 6'3" and I'm 5'10" and a bit. So anyway,
yeah.
Let's talk about the Labour leadership race in a little more detail. I mean, we've got to remember we're trying not to get the listeners to turn off here. So I know that people are thinking, "Oh God, can I skip the next 10 minutes?" But it clearly matters that Britain needs a proper opposition party, and it grieves me that it doesn't seem to be getting one. The case for Starmer, who has not really had a... He looks like, I mean, he's going to win, isn't he? But he's not winning in a very impressive way.
Seb Payne of the FT said it was sewn up, basically. Or he's been speaking to Labour people who said it's all sewn up now with Starmer.
Well, it just looks that way because of the way that the CLPs have fallen and just it has this momentum, for want of a better word, feel to it, but it's so uninspiring.
Someone put it quite well. He's suffering from the same problem that Theresa May suffered from, in that people sort of thought she had a personality and that it would at some point express itself and trusted her to express herself at some point. But you know, she never cultivated a public personality, whatever she's like in private. It was almost deliberate. And the public never got to know her in a real way, and when they did, they thought she was weird. And Starmer suffers from a slight similar problem, is that the authenticity that the campaign seems to be rooted in, I'm the son of a toolmaker. Well, he's not, he's the son of a man who owned a tool factory. He's quite different.
Yeah.
You know, it's slightly forced, you know, personality, authenticity that doesn't really resonate with how managerial he is, and how much of a, and focus groups say about Starmer, he just comes across like a sort of suit, like a guy who's very accomplished in a business setting and can give a good presentation, but doesn't have much there, which is probably unfair.
But that's
the problem, I think, is that maybe some of his strategists, I mean, he looks at the campaign rally had last week, where it was a real Corbyn style rally, and everyone had been given a little placard, and he was up on stage like a superstar. It was at like the Roundhouse in Shaw Farm, and it was just like, you know, this manufacturing collective energy, which is at the root of all totalitarianism, actually, is manufacturing collective sentiment where none really exists. It just comes across as kitsch and naff and just like, well,
it's slightly unfair because I like
Starmer for president.
Slightly unfair because I like Ed Miliband. But people are saying it's Keir Starmer is just Ed Miliband with a knighthood.
Yeah.
Which is, there's something in that. I mean, sorry to be really reductive about it and centrist, but I just find it so. I can't believe how left wing they are. I mean, they're such a bunch of lefties. I know that you've got a different view from me on Nandi. I have been so disappointed with her in this race, and I don't think that she's just. I don't think she's pandering. I know that the electorate or the selectorate is left. course, I get all of that, though significant parts of the Labour Party and party membership are not as left as people think or assume. Otherwise, look at candidate selection. Some of the people who are MPs wouldn't still be MPs. But I know she's always been of the left, but I mean, it's like Neil Kinnock's of the was of the soft left or was of the proper left, Benite's left, effectively, and then moved with great dexterity. Now I know Kinnock's not everyone's cup of tea. There'll be listeners to this podcast who voted against him, but it's quite an adroit series of manoeuvres to get from there to then win the leadership and fudge certain positions and then begin the modernisation of the Labour Party. She is just a real lefty.
Well, I think if the candidate I would have liked to have seen running was Stephen Kinnock, ironically, the son of, I think he's the most, he's shilly-shallied a bit over the Brexit position, but I thought he was doing so in the way Starmer was shilly-shallying, which was in a cynical way, but in a...
He was one of the few people who was genuinely trying to get to a moderate Brexit.
And he was engaging
compromise.
With it. And, I mean, we forget the atmosphere around the beginning of last year when May kept on bringing back the deal. I mean, and...
A nightmare a year ago, yeah.
Yeah, but Kinnock was, I think, involved in trying to work out a way of... And negotiating with Theresa May and her team may have been difficult. I've no idea.
Norway Plus and Norway for Now and all that stuff, we've completely forgotten about it.
Anyway, having seen him speak at a think tank event once, I found him really thoughtful and convincing and, you know, just the sort of person. And I think Namdi still is a thoughtful person, but she, I think, has just been quite, maybe... I think she's been quite canny, because what she needs to do in the next round is basically be everyone's second preference, which will allow her to progress. And that, you do that by, I imagine, hitting these talking point notes in the right way.
Yeah.
For example, on the self-ID question over
we disagree on this.
Well, in that debate, whatever you say, whatever commitment you make, it is completely polarizing at the moment, because there is no common language in that debate. There's no language of conciliation that you can strike that is recognisable to people. So I think whatever she was going to say, it was going to piss off a wide variety of people.
But there is a way you can do that.
Well,
I think the lesson is from Blair.
Yeah.
So if you look at what the roots of all of them, Blair did tons of stuff which has, you know, the roots of that stuff on transgenderism and government policy has its roots in the Blair government, and he just, but they did stuff and didn't talk about it. So the answer was to deflect. The answer was that she was being asked a question by someone from Women's Place UK, an organisation which is controversial. I'm with them. You're not, but.
Well, I don't really know, to be honest.
But a good politician. Sorry, that's presumptuous. But our positions are slightly different on it. But I it's clearly a question coming from someone from Women's Place UK. Now you can say, well, good for her. She answered it completely honestly and revealed her position, which has then just infuriated feminists and who've now got this hashtag going. You know, expel me from the Labour Party. But the smart political Blairite thing to do is to deflect it and say, there's a lot of sort of heat and light around this, and I'm sorry, I think we're talking about the wrong things here. We're getting sucked into issues which are just, it's not what people really want to talk about and really want to think about, and just deflect.
Yeah.
And it's infuriating to some people, but the message that's then heard by the punter, which is the former Labour voter who now just feels that Labour Party's on Mars, is, if they do tune into something like that, they hear the message, this person knows that I'm interested in other things, I'm not interested in all that PC rubbish, even if that's her, if her position is not aligned completely with those voters.
But she's been, it's of a piece with the way she's handled the other stuff, she's not been particularly good at communicating it.
The monarchy.
Yeah, the monarchy, she sort of fudged it and said, well, if there was a referendum, you know, I would vote to abolish the monarchy if such a thing happened.
I mean, that's hopeless, isn't it?
Yeah, but I know, but you know, she's not the greatest person.
But she's running.
I'm a fan simply because she is. She's not been good at communicating her policy.
Yeah.
But she does have a certain something, and the Labour Party is in such a state that you just need someone who's a bit of personality and a bit of verve. And I think if you look at the way focus groups have reacted, I mean, Channel 4 News does good broadcasts of these if you ever want to look. A lot of voters are looking for a style, and I think the content is sort of secondary to that.
I agree.
And it's being a bit more ready to defend your positions, and then people will take you on directly or disagree with you mm-hmm. in good faith. And she is a lot better at sort of saying things in good faith and not taking bullshit from interviewers who think that politicians are there just to be whacked around the head.
And it's better than Starmer, who is just robotic.
Who cannot say anything beyond, the 10 pledges were just complete morbid thoughts, you know, it's all about unity. I mean, I almost laughed when one of the pledges was to be an effective opposition. I mean, it's painting my numbers stuff. But on the self-ID, just to come back to that, I think there is a principled way you can talk about the debate without getting drawn into it. I think on self-ID, I don't have particularly well worked out views in it. I do know that in the West, and this is going to be a bit of a pretentious point, we do have a problem in that, particularly in the last 30 years, gender roles have become much more clearly defined, and that sort of happened in the 90s in advertising, with sort of boys and girls toys, all that. And I think it's a contingent thing. It's relatively recent. If you look at archive footage of the 70s or read Girls' Own manuals, all the girls are wearing trousers. There's much more fluidity.
But it was the 70s. We were all on drugs.
Yeah, and the androgyny of the 60s, that's a major cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think these things come and go, and I think the orthodoxy is resetting around a different view of it. And what makes me sad is that potentially that creativity, of the androgynous creativity, is perhaps being lost and is being segmented into quite radically opposed views of how you self-identify. So it's either totally cis, or whatever the word is, to within your gender, or you're between, or you're migrating. Whereas actually, you know, it's, these things we're always negotiating.
I know, I understand that.
But I think
understand
that's
not new.
Changing. But self-ID, I do think there is a spectre that is raised slight on the sort of second. There is sometimes an eerie quality to it where self-ID is seen as a sort of rapist charter for, you know, malign men to get round to access women's spaces, and I think that is probably a tiny minority
I understand that. You make a good point about this not being new as a concept. My objection is more fundamental than that, and it's to do with the extreme.
Yeah,
which is actually the extreme has captured the mainstream when you look at organisations like Stonewall and the culture of demanding that people comply. No debate is the slogan. No debate, literally, which is kind of chilling in itself. And I'm afraid I can see your point. I'm very much with the women and feminists who are saying, well, this is ultimately in its most radical form a misogynistic attempt to abolish women or to terrorize women and make them shut up. Hence the phrase "no debate." Anyway,
it's true. You can never. You're right. You can never do. And I'm very much of the opinion that these gender and sexuality, you can never. These are so complex, and it's in the West we have all these funny neuroticisms and weird feelings around it. Whether that's, you know, the cult of the mother goddess in ancient Rome, where men would castrate themselves to be part of it. You know, unless you're a brilliant communicator like Blair, who was very had a great alacrity for that sort of thing. There just seems to be no common ground.
So it worked out that they need Tony Blair.
Yeah.
Tony, but he's not
forgiven.
I wouldn't go that far.
The thing is, whenever I see him speak, I do think, oh, you're just great, aren't you? And it happens to interviews.
Yes, but you, didn't have to live through it.
But he bewitches interviewers, and it happened. I remember watching him on Andrew Marr a few years ago, and Andrew Marr, who's already, he's not the most aggressive interviewer, by then it was just sort of like two old friendos just talking about the state of politics in general.
Yes, that's Blair's gift. But yeah. I can tell you, having lived through it, there were substantial downsides.
I'm sure.
But so I think we're just going to wrap things up there for this week, aren't we? But so, as Alistair said earlier, if you're not a subscriber to Reaction, can't believe that you're not, go to the website www.reaction.life and become a subscriber. Only £5 a month or £52 for the year, and you get my weekly email and a newsletter, Alistair's brilliant daily email from the Reaction team, all sorts of other things. I've also got an event coming up with Helen Lewis on her fascinating new book on feminism on March the 4th, and that's a bargain. You get the book included, and you also get the event hosted by Maggie Pagano, executive editor of Reaction, and you also get a drink. So the event is on the website, on the events page, with Helen Lewis on March the 4th. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and tune in next time.